Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, an accident I-10 westbound at 75th Avenue has that off-ramp blocked. Meanwhile, Valley weather for the rest of today, we're supposed to see mostly sunny skies at some point and perhaps reach a high of 61. Then for tonight, a very slight chance for showers and lows around 40. Should be sunny for tomorrow, still below normal, with a high of 62. Currently, relative humidity is at 51%, cloudy and 57 degrees. Governor Doug Ducey announced two Supreme Court appointments today as part of a body expanding from 5 to 7 justices. The two are Arizona Court of Appeals Judge Andrew Gould and Arizona Solicitor General John Lopez, who will be the first Latino in the court's history. The governor told Capital Media Services that having the additional qualified justices will benefit the court and the state.
I think that the court is going to be able to do a larger share of the necessary work that's important for the state. I also think it right-sizes the court to states of equal size and equal population. And I think that the court can take on more cases where needed and necessary to make appropriate rulings.
Gould and Lopez were among 7 finalists Ducey was presented by the Arizona Commission on Appellate Court Appointments. Election results in Maricopa County can now be considered official. The Maricopa County Board of Supervisors canvassed the numbers in a special board meeting downtown this morning. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there and joins us now. Carrie, can you quickly explain what does it mean when we say the Board of Supervisors has canvassed the election results?
Well, you actually already said it, Steve. This just means that the counting in the county is done. Provisional ballots have been investigated, and these numbers will be the official results that the elections will be decided on. Now that we have the official numbers, County Recorder Helen Purcell also noted that voter turnout this year was down. She said it was the lowest since the 2000 elections.
Were the supervisors concerned about anything they saw in the final numbers that were given by the County Recorder's office?
Well, there were a few technical questions that they had, but one of the bigger ones was what took so long? I mean, it's been almost 3 weeks since Election Day, and County Recorder Purcell said the delay was the result of the number of early ballots that they received. In total, the office counted about 1,250,000 of them. The majority of those were counted before Election Day, but here in Maricopa County, you can turn in an early ballot on Election Day at a polling location. So Purcell says her office collected about 290,000 on Election Day itself, and those just take time to verify, process, and then count.
What about doing something about that in the future? Can the county make any changes to that?
Yes, actually. After the meeting, Board Chairman Steve Chukri said, knowing that this method of voting is growing in popularity like it is, the board will likely look into taking some action in the future. Now, that will obviously require some funding, and the board will have to approve any new plan that may come into play.
Is there items that we can do and change or look into to make sure that we're most efficient and we can be quick to the job?
Something else held up the early ballot processing this year, too. Director of Elections Karen Osborne says election-related lawsuits also slowed down the counting process.
Day after day after day after day, even on Election Day, going for injunctions, and we would have to stop the people that needed to do the work in order to get the data to answer the questions.
And before we finish up, we know supervisors did consider one more item on the special meeting agenda. That was an adjustment to this year's budget. Carrie, what was that about, and why was that money needed after we're already well into the fiscal year?
So this money is intended for the County Medical Examiner's Office. Over the summer, KJZZ reported that the office got a budget increase to hire 2 additional pathologists. Those are the doctors that perform the autopsies. That passed unanimously today, so the hiring process can officially begin.
KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the show on 91.5, and with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today. I'm Steve Goldstein. Donald Trump, the president-elect of the United States, says more than 2 million people voted illegally in the presidential election. He said there is serious voter fraud in Virginia, New Hampshire, and California. There is no evidence for any of this aside from a conspiracy on the internet. But it sounds like the person who won by less than 100,000 votes across 4 swing states would like a recount.
Of course, Donald Trump does not want a recount, but that isn't stopping his false claims from undermining the integrity of an election that he won. Well, Trump's statements came out on his Twitter account last night after Green Party candidate Jill Stein raised enough money for a recount in Wisconsin. And that's an effort the Clinton campaign is now behind. Clinton's team says they'll also support efforts to recount the vote in Michigan and Pennsylvania later on. Though they don't think the recounts will change the outcome of the election, the Clinton and Stein teams are pushing for the recount after growing suspicion that Russia interfered in the election and after a prominent computer scientist noted irregularities in the vote count. Purvi Vora is a professor of computer science at George Washington University. She says the recount isn't as much about changing the outcome as it is about assuring voter integrity and confidence, especially in the face of false claims made by the president-elect.
There isn't any evidence of voter fraud. And in fact, in the instances where claims have been investigated in the past by reputable nonpartisan organizations, they found that there's no basis to such claims. Yet they're made repeatedly in an effort to sort of downplay an outcome or downplay something that a candidate doesn't like. And I think rather than do it this way, rather than appeal to emotion and kind of get people all riled up, maybe we should take the scientific approach to this. And so, you know, let's do what science tells us to do in the case of elections, which is end every election with an audit. In the absence of the possibility of an audit, do a recount. But, you know, access the evidence that you have about the outcome and go about looking at it to see what it says about an outcome.
So let's step back now and go to Wisconsin, where a recount sponsored by Jill Stein and her many donors is about to start. An audit versus a recount. You said those are two different things. Can you just help us understand the difference between an election audit and the actual recount that's going to be happening in Wisconsin and maybe other states as well?
So the main difference is that an audit samples the ballots. So in both cases, we want to look at the ballots, at the paper ballots that have been stored as evidence. And by looking at them and manually examining them, we want to tell if they're consistent with the outcome, if the outcome is consistent with these ballots. And so with respect to an audit, we might just need to sample a few ballots, and that sampling, if done correctly at random and independent with independent draws and so on, might tell us enough about the outcome with just a few ballots. Whereas a recount is a complete recount of the specific jurisdictions where it's requested, or the specific sets of ballots or precincts and so on.
Of course, if you do a complete recount without the audit, you may simply repeat any errors, if they existed, that you had in the first place.
Well, so that's why a recount should be done by hand and not using the electronic machines that are vulnerable to all kinds of problems, including error and intentional alteration. So if there was an error in scanner calibration, for example, or if there was some intentional effort to alter votes, then you would detect that there's a difference between what the ballots are saying and what these machines appear to be saying.
So given the margins that we saw in the election, 10,000 votes in Wisconsin, around 65 or 70,000 votes in a place like Pennsylvania, is a recount likely to change the outcome here? Is that the point?
No. So the point really isn't let's change the outcome or anything like that. I think the computer scientists, statisticians, the election integrity specialists have been saying this for a long time now, 10, 20 years more than that, that we just want to confirm the outcome. And it's not about changing it. It's not about preferring one candidate or another. An audit is sort of an essential piece of an election. An election is not done till you actually look at the evidence that supports the outcome.
You know, Purvi Vora, it seems like we have these two different groups of people ever since the election. We have the computer scientists, people like you, who say the science doesn't lie, audits should always be performed, let's deal with this rationally. You have the election watchers and professional vote counters and analysts who've gone back into the voting results, let's say in Wisconsin, and have said, everybody relax, this has nothing to do with hacking. Differences in education and race and voter patterns fully explain why voting patterns were different between computerized ballots and paper ballots. It's because of the voters, not because of hacking, and you're all being stupid.
Statistical patterns are not evidence, right? So the statistics could be different, and you could still have a good election, or the statistics might be the same, and you have a bad election. Because looking at this, you know, at polls and looking at statistical patterns in the ballots is not the same in the outcomes, is not the same as looking at the ballots. The ballots are the evidence. And so it's not really so much about patterns and stuff. That is not really looking at the evidence, and that's besides the point. I don't think we should have to look at that and explain the statistical irregularities or irregularities or whatever. We should actually be looking at the evidence. That's the ballots.
Purvi Vora is professor of computer science at George Washington University. Professor, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. When Phoenix City Councilman Bill Gates stepped down to run for the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors in May, he left a coveted seat on the council open. Former city planner Deborah Stark was temporarily appointed to the position this summer, and a slew of rival candidates came forward to face her on November 8th for a special election for a permanent position. But the votes have been counted, and none of the candidates won a majority of the vote. Now Stark is facing a runoff election against Phoenix attorney Chris DeRose in March. The show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. And Lauren, tell us a little bit more about these two candidates.
Right. So Deborah Stark was a longtime planning director for the city and for Maricopa County, and it's kind of her first foray into politics with this election. Chris DeRose is an attorney and an author who used to work in the attorney general's office, and he is pretty well known in political circles, I'm told. Now, these are nonpartisan elections for the city council, so nobody's party affiliation will appear on the ballot. But I spoke with Dustin Gardner about this today. He's the Phoenix City Hall reporter at the Arizona Republic, and he says that doesn't mean that party identification doesn't come into play in these campaigns.
Chris DeRose is a registered Republican, and he's often emphasized that in this campaign. Deborah Stark is a registered Democrat, but she's emphasized that she considers herself to be fairly moderate and doesn't look at things through a partisan lens. And in her opinion, she thinks city elections should be more about delivery of local services than about partisan ideology.
So Stark has the advantage going into this runoff. She got about 41% of the vote in the November 8th election. DeRose got about half that. And Gardner says if she wins the runoff, it could really change the political balance of the council.
Bill Gates, who had held the seat, is a Republican, and his leaving could change the makeup of the body. Since Stark is a Democrat, that would eliminate one of the reliably conservative votes on the council. DeRose is a conservative Republican and would probably be more along the lines of Bill Gates from an ideological perspective. That said, Stark has tilted right on some of her first council votes. She opposed a property tax increase, and she also opposed creating a city ID that would be available to undocumented immigrants.
So even though these are bipartisan elections, give us an idea of kind of who's backing who here.
Stark has gotten a lot of support from the development community. You know, those are relationships she's had since her time as planning director. And she's also gotten a lot of support from the Firefighters Union, which wields a lot of power in city elections. On the Republican side, Chris DeRose has gotten a lot of support from well-known Republican leaders like Councilman Jim Waring, Sal DiCicco. You have Congressman Dave Schweikert, also Attorney General Mark Brnovich.
Is this a conservative district?
So District 3 is one of the city's most active and traditionally conservative council districts. While turnout in city elections often isn't very high, this district is one of the more active ones. And previous council members in this district, most recently Bill Gates, have often been Republicans who have been more conservative leaning.
So are you surprised, I guess, by the results that Deborah Stark is, you know, pulling pretty well at this point?
I think a lot of political insiders expected there to be a tighter race between Chris DeRose and Deborah Stark. The fact that she captured 41% of the vote, I think that surprised a lot of people. And, you know, she really doesn't have to make up that much ground to get over 50% and win outright in March. That said, there were factors helping her. Obviously, you know, she's had the interim appointment and been the incumbent since June. And she also raised quite a bit more. I think she raised about $160,000. That was far more than what DeRose was able to raise in the first leg of the race. Yeah, obviously, that would play to her advantage. And that was a lot of strong support from developers that were giving money to her.
How does it play in that developers seem to be backing her?
Both candidates in this sense are probably going to be regarded as fairly pro-business. How they would handle individual development or zoning cases in the district, it's hard to say. But I think the fact that Stark has so much support from developers and the real estate community that, I guess, sort of indicates that they feel like she would be a fairly good ally and a reliable person for them to look to. I think another piece of that, too, is just the fact that she was planning director at the city and the county, and she's someone that people in the building community know and work with and have that kind of relationship, and they obviously would want an ally on the council seat.
That was Dustin Gardner, the Phoenix City Hall reporter for the Arizona Republic. The runoff election for the District 3 seat on the Phoenix City Council is March 14th.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Phil Latzman.
And Steve, the world is still reacting to the death of longtime Cuban leader Fidel Castro on Friday, and the reverberations are even being felt here in Arizona.
It's estimated that there are at least 8,000 Cuban-American families here in the state, some coming here as far back as the 1940s and 50s, and others who've settled here more recently.
Alberto Gutierrez has been in the Grand Canyon State for nearly five decades and served under four administrations as director of the Governor's Office of Highway Safety. He and his family came to the U.S. to escape the Castro regime in 1960, a year after Fidel took power. And when we spoke earlier, he talked about the hope that Fidel represented at the time of the revolution a year before he fled.
Well, because what happened is a lot of the media, the national media, New York Times and others, were able to make Fidel Castro like a great hero of the Cuban world, when I remember very clearly, since I had some hope for Cuba, get rid of dictatorships and come in with a democratic government. I remember my own dad, 3 months after Fidel took power in Cuba, and my dad said to me, "Be careful, this is a communist regime." And I said, "Dad, come on." He said, "No, there's people who are communists in that government. Be careful." And I saw it coming, and then Fidel Castro, of course, declared himself a communist way back later on, after Bay of Pigs, when my brother-in-law and his brother were the frogmen who put the lights on the beach in Bay of Pigs and were captured and spent 20 months in Cuban prison, that I realized what communism meant for Cuba and the destruction of the island and the lack of liberty for the Cuban people.
This is certainly not Miami here, but there's a good amount of Cuban families that ended up settling in Arizona just like you did. Do you think most people realize that you say there's 8,000 Cuban families living here?
At least 8,000 that I know of. This is based on what the International Rescue Committee has told us over the years. And the International Rescue Committee shepherds some. I remember myself 15, 20 years ago after the three waves. First was the Mariel boat lift, brought a bunch of Cubans here. Then the Balseros brought another ton of Cubans here. And after the Balseros came the economic exodus of these Cuban families, which, you know, they're fine. I'm glad they're here. I run into some of them quite often at retail stores like Costco and other places, and, you know, they have a unique accent like I do. So we know they're Cubans. And at the same time, these people, they call the United States and here in Phoenix, Cuba with food, okay? Means that, you know, they haven't really assimilated into us. And people that come to America, like I did as an immigrant, with permanent residence in a car way back in 1960, we need to adopt that culture. Some of this Cuban family have not. And I urge them all the time the same thing. Please, learn the language. Learn how what the United States is all about. But at the same time, don't forget your heritage and your culture. Just, you can keep it here. You can still speak in Spanish. You can still do your things. But live the American way of life like my family does.
Do you still have family that live on the island?
No, I have none. Majority of my family, because we're a very political family, in the 40s and 50s, they all left the country. They're here in other countries, but mostly in Florida and New Jersey. So my wife has a couple of relatives left, and that's it.
So will you ever go back?
Hell no. And I'll tell you why I say it that way. I want to remember the Cuba that I left in 1960. My wife is the same way. We ain't going back. I don't want to visit either. I've been asked to visit by a number of media outlets to be a kind of a guiding tour. No, thank you. I don't want to see the poverty, the destruction of the buildings and everything else that we had. And that's the kind of things that hurts me pretty bad.
Alberto Gutierrez is director of the Governor's Office of Highway Safety here in Arizona. A Cuban-American who fled Castro's Cuba over 50 years ago. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Take care. Thanks for the interview.
And Phil, now that Fidel Castro is gone, is Gutierrez holding out any hope that there will be a real new era of relations with Cuba?
No, he says that until Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, is out, that there really is not going to be any hope for people on the island or renewed relations, because he says that Raul is even worse than his brother.
KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
For those suffering from a mental health issue, finding care can be a lengthy process. Behavioral health providers are in short supply nationwide and here in the Valley. Many patients end up turning to the emergency room in the hopes of finding a quick diagnosis and treatment. But most ERs are not equipped to handle psychiatric patients. And as Jimmy Jenkins reports from KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, the issue is forcing healthcare providers to look for alternatives.
Each year, about 36 million people in the United States experience a mental health disorder. For some of us, this might mean dealing with depression, but for others, a behavioral health problem can come in the form of a psychiatric emergency, which can lead them here, to the emergency room.
Some of them are suicidal. Some people actually have schizophrenia or psychotic episodes where they just can't take care of themselves, or they're doing something that is off the wall.
Dr. Robert Porter is the ER director at Banner Goldfield Hospital in Apache Junction. He has 8 beds for emergency patients, but they're often filled with mental health patients waiting to be diagnosed by a specialist. At Banner Goldfield, there's no psychiatrist on site, and this hospital is not alone. According to Kaiser Health, 48 states are designated as health professional shortage areas, meaning they don't have enough mental health practitioners to meet demand. According to the same research, Arizona has one of the largest shortages in the country, more than 200 shy of what experts say they need. Porter says mental health patients sometimes end up waiting hours, even days, in the ER for a diagnosis, which can exacerbate their already fragile condition.
It can be very frustrating for them, because that would drive me crazy to be in a room in the bright lights that we have and not getting the care that they need.
It's frustrating for Dr. Porter, too, because while he watches psychiatric patients go without care, his other patients build up in the waiting room.
What happens is that ERs have become the de facto dumping ground for psychiatric patients, which has ripple effects for non-psychiatric patients as well.
Dr. Renee Shaw is a professor of emergency medicine and works at an ER in San Francisco. She says data from the past decade shows psychiatric visits to ERs have gone up by 55%, and wait times have skyrocketed as well. She says market conditions are a major contributing factor. Many mental health patients who turn to the ER for treatment are uninsured or on Medicaid.
And because Medicaid tends to be a low payer, they have low reimbursement rates, a lot of psychiatrists may not even want to accept them, and so it's hard to get these patients placement.
One way to treat patients faster is through what are known as telepsych appraisals. Dr. Clifford McNaughton is a psychiatrist sitting in his office in Iowa, but through a video kiosk and a really fast internet connection, he can evaluate patients here at Banner Goldfield in Apache Junction. He says he approaches a long-distance diagnosis in the same manner as if he were bedside.
Well, first, I just introduce myself and explain what the purpose is. I just want to understand more about what your situation is, where you had to end up at the emergency room.
McNaughton can then work with the ER physicians on a treatment plan and refer patients to the proper service provider. But even after the diagnosis, demand for beds still outpaces supply, so much so that Banner Health is building a new behavioral health hospital. They're expanding the campus here in Scottsdale.
The Phoenix market is tighter. There's just less beds here for those individuals that need them, and we run a very high occupancy.
Banner Behavioral Health CEO Brian Buten says about 16,000 mental health patients show up in Banner's ERs every year. The new behavioral health hospital will be able to handle emergency evaluations as well as provide longer-term inpatient care. Dr. Gagandeep Singh is the chief medical officer. He says the new space will provide an opportunity to conduct more thorough treatment to keep patients from having to return again and again for deeper underlying problems.
Somebody who's got significant depression with a coexisting substance use problem, that's a separate cohort of patients where you can really customize their treatment.
After a few days to a week, patients can then transition to outpatient services and get back to their lives.
These are all people who could be any of us, and these are people that are our family members and our friends who happen to be in a crisis.
The new behavioral health hospital will be open next year. Singh says it'll be a place where patients can feel safe and get well. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Despite the imminent death of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, Trans-Pacific trade generally still has somewhere to run. China, for example, has begun a multi-billion-dollar investment program into the new Silk Road, a path of rail and road connections that'll run through Central Asia to help connect its factories with European and Middle Eastern markets. And Beijing, it seems, is still looking to U.S. businesses for help to complete the project, as the BBC's Jane O'Brien reports.
Marco Polo is probably the most famous Westerner to travel the Silk Road. He spent 24 years exploring Asia, and his voyage back to Venice in the late 13th century took more than 2 years. He made a fortune, wrote a book, and gave Europeans their first real glimpse of China and the world beyond. China is now trying to resurrect the ancient Silk Road trading route with a rather more prosaically titled One Belt, One Road initiative, a network of railroads, highways, pipelines, and ports with an initial Chinese investment of $40 billion.
For Western audiences, this often sounds like a propaganda ploy or a slogan without much meaning.
Yukon Huang is a former World Bank director for China and is now a senior associate at the Carnegie Asia Program. He says that for decades, China has been looking across the Pacific at its biggest economic rival, the U.S. Now it's looking west at markets in Central and Southeast Asia, the Middle East and Europe. But the Middle Kingdom needs a way to reach them.
It's actually a strategic, a potentially comprehensive framework that encompasses China's economic and foreign policy intentions in Asia.
While China is prepared to pay for its new Silk Road, it still needs help building it. And for that, it's turning to the US. Political relations may be frosty at times and likely to grow colder under a Trump administration, but, says Qichong Fong, chairman of the China International Contractors Association, market forces are often more powerful than politics.
Business is business. I'm on the business side, and I see profits and see opportunities. Whenever there is the opportunities and also the profits, no company will refuse. And I think American companies are the same. Government is government. They talk like politics, but for business people, they're always behind the profits. So I see the great potential opportunities for us to cooperate.
Mr. Fong was speaking at a recent trade conference hosted in Washington by the Eurasia Center, a business coalition promoting links with Europe and Asia. One major U.S. company betting heavily on the Silk Road project is Caterpillar, despite historic losses in China following a slump in commodities. Tom Paulette is group president of construction at Caterpillar, which remains the world's largest seller of earth-moving equipment.
For us, it is a natural project which we are perfectly positioned to help with, because of our, you know, our presence for 90 years around the world, our strong dealer network, and of course we've been active in China for 40 years, so we celebrated 40 years last year.
One of the Silk Road nations that stands to benefit from China's massive infrastructure investment is Georgia. It has free trade agreements with China and Europe and sees economic improvement as the best way to strengthen democracy in a turbulent region. But Georgia's special envoy to the U.S., Grigory Tsakolia, says U.S. commercial involvement is essential to counter Russian and Chinese expansion.
This is the reason why we are so happy to see that the largest infrastructural development that is taking place currently on the coast of the Black Sea, the development of the deep sea port, is done by the consortium of the companies that include U.S. companies. And when you look at the Chinese companies, we see heavy Chinese presence in infrastructural development, and we see that the interest from the Chinese companies is increasing as well.
As long as China doesn't grow weary of investing abroad while growth slows at home, many U.S. businesses see great opportunity in the Silk Road project. But Caterpillar's Tom Paulette says they'd better be quick.
The train is leaving the station. There's many, many projects that have already been funded. There will be trillions of dollars invested, billions of people affected, dozens of countries. It's probably never too late to become involved, but the projects are moving, and by the time everything's said and done, whether it's 30 years or 40 years from now, it will be the biggest undertaking by mankind when you look at all the infrastructure that will go into place.
That was Caterpillar's Vice President Tom Paulette ending that report by the BBC's Jane O'Brien. In KJZZ News at 2:38, winter has arrived in northern Arizona. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports cities like Flagstaff and Williams are cleaning up after multiple inches of snow fell over the weekend.
The National Weather Service reports more than 5 inches of snow fell in the first official snowstorm of the season in Flagstaff. The same weather system has also brought as much as 0.2 inches of rain to the valley. Temperatures in both regions are expected to remain low through much of the week. Another storm front is expected Friday, but isn't projected to produce as much moisture as in the past weekend. Catherine Furkey, KJZZ News.
In a check of international news, an amusement park in Japan has been forced to close its skating rink after a torrent of online criticism over its new centerpiece, thousands of fish frozen into the ice. Space World in southwest Japan bowed to pressure to close the facility after campaigners denounced the display as, quote, cruel, immoral, and weird. The BBC's Pete Ross reports.
Themed attraction earlier this month. Skaters were offered the chance to glide over 5,000 fish literally frozen into the surface of the ice rink. Pictures were posted on Facebook showing fish half submerged in the ice with their mouths open, while others were arranged to form arrows under the ice. Photos also appeared to show exotic sea creatures such as rays and crabs, though the park said these were only enlarged pictures, not real creatures. The park defended itself against criticism, saying it only used fish that were already dead and unfit for consumption. But the story has hit a public nerve and reminded many of the power of social media in the corporate world.
The BBC's Pete Ross. Among others, members of the creative class have expressed alarm at how the election of Donald Trump to the White House could affect society, tolerance, acceptance, even humor. Writer and consultant Tanya Catan, CEO of Creative Trespassing, understands those worries, but she also says this is a time for creatives to go very public with their ideas and respond forcefully. Catan addresses some of that in a piece she wrote for Phoenix New Times called 7 Ways Creatives Can Bounce Back in Trump's America. And Tanya, why did Donald Trump's victory make you feel like you needed to get pumped up to counter it in some way?
I think that historically, creatives have the skills, the tools to reframe the things and ideas that we see every day. So when we find ourselves in situations where we're like, you know, where people are picking on us or the world is sort of spiraling out of control, we have ways to frame that and show people why it's important to stop and look at the world before there's a catastrophe. I don't think this is about Trump specifically. This is about a culture that leads with binaries and sort of divisive tactics. I mean, if you think about the political process, there are basically two ways in which you can vote, right? It's like Republican, Democrat. There's binary right there. And so when you have a two-party system, it's setting you up for like either or. And I say, do away with the parties.
So creatives have to get people to open their minds then.
Yes. Gosh.
But can they do it?
They are doing it. They have been doing it for years.
But so is that just going to be stifled then in Trump's America?
I think that creatives have the ability to create whether or not they're in a prison cell, whether or not they're being detained. Creativity involves a mindset and some understanding of how to make connections between two disparate things in the world. In fact, the story that I just wrote for Phoenix New Times, one of the artists that I talk about is Adrienne Piper, who she's still around and teaching. And in the 70s, she did this project called Calling Cards, where she is of sort of multiple races. And so when she's in public spaces, and especially in the 70s, people didn't necessarily read her as, you know, as black or white or whatever. And so they would say things sometimes that were culturally insensitive to part of who she was. And instead of saying, you suck, or I'd like to be divisive too, or whatever, she had these pre-printed calling cards that said, hello, perhaps you didn't know that I am black. And that's why you said the thing that was, you know, complicated and hurt me. But I am. And so let's have a conversation about it.
Do you feel like we're the average person? By average, I mean someone who's not in the creative realm. Recognizes or forgets how important creativity is in our everyday lives, the fact that whether you're someone who likes more traditional stuff, like I'm going to go to Arizona Theater Company, or I'm going to go to Smoker, or I'm going to go to some edgy box that has like 10 people fitting in it. Do you think we're not conscious enough? Like every day we need this, and people who are creative who look like us or don't, we need that as part of our lives.
Totally. I think that if you're able to see everyday life and situations through a creative lens, your life and those around you will be exponentially better. And I'll give you one example. And it's really just about, we're not limited in what we see. We're limited in how we're seeing it, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's a fitness club locally, and maybe the national, and that's all I'll say about that. As a creative person, I'm looking at all of these symbols and ideas, and they have, you know, they have quotes on the walls, and I'm reading all the things, and there's this quote on the wall at the gym, and it says, "It's the way we make you feel." And I'm like, that is so sweet. Like, I love that quote. And then I look just to the, just literally 5 inches to the right, and there's a camera aimed on me, a video camera. So they're recording me and anything I might do wrong, and then they're going to bust me. So I'm like, it's the way they make me feel. Oh, I feel like intimidated now. I feel like I'm going to get arrested. So it's those everyday juxtapositions that exist in the world that are we as creative people look at and we call attention to, perhaps. And we're also wanting everybody to see that they can call attention to it too.
You've got a list. I don't want to go over all 7 ways, but for your New Times piece, 7 ways creatives can bounce back in Trump's America. I want to go to number 6, because number 6, National Adopt an Adversary Day. One of the things to do is friend Ivanka Trump. So serious or just funny?
No, totally serious. Okay. Going back to this like binary system, and it's right or wrong, it's Republican or Democrat, da, da, da. That's why we're in this space where a lot of us feel a sense of fear, right? It's because we don't know. Yeah. We don't know. We haven't been having these conversations. And some of us have, and some of us haven't. And this is a time of reckoning and reconciling. And so Ivanka Trump, I'm totally going to be friends with her. I mean, I will request friendship from her, and I will wait to see if she accepts my friend request. We have a lot in common. We're both about women empowerment. We're both about women empowerment specifically in the workplace. I'm certain that she tells her dad, hey, don't dye your hair. And I tell my dad the same thing.
I wanted to ask you about this. You've written a bit about going into the American Girl store. As someone who walks in and does her thing, but in some ways, people might think, oh, my God, she's challenging conventions, even if you're just being yourself. Can you give a Cliff's Notes version of that story, how you went in like looking for a doll that looked like you?
So here's the skinny. It's American Doll. So presumably each doll might represent part of who we are as American, like girls and young women and women. And so I just kind of did my own like little like, oh, it's my lunch break. I'll get a cappuccino and do a sociological study on whether or not there's an American doll that looks like me. I'm an American. I was born here and I'm a girl. And where's my doll? And so I went in and casually asked, you know, hey, is there a doll that looks like me? And they sort of looked me over. And for those of you listening to this on the radio, I have short, spiky hair, big sort of Elvis Costello glasses, and an attitude to match. And I was wearing like a, you know, like a vegan leather jacket, which is code for plastic. And I went into American Doll, and they're like, well, there was like a moment of sort of like collective discomfort, yeah, of like, where's her doll? They have a boy doll that kind of looks a little bit like me. And so we got the boy doll, and I'm like, oh.
Did you think that the people working there were like, oh boy, why is this person challenging
no.
us?
And I also, just so you know, Steve, I'm not going in there and saying like, yeah, do you have my doll? Like what? Right, right. Like, where's my doll? I'm not there to confront people. I'm there to actually start a conversation. And the conversation is, hey, do you have a doll that looks like me? And maybe they realize like, I don't. And there could be other boyish girls out there or sort of like young people who don't ascribe to a specific gender. And so I think it's important for me to go into those spaces and just casually start a conversation.
Tanya Catan is CEO of Creative Trespassing. Her recent Phoenix New Times story is called 7 Ways Creatives Can Bounce Back in Trump's America. As families gather for the holidays, some parents want their adult children to leave with more than new memories. They're hoping to unload antique furniture, collectibles, and family heirlooms. But as Christina Estes reports from the KJZZ Business Desk, many baby boomers are discovering their treasures aren't valued as much as they expected.
Come on out.
Inside Claudia Kunkel's garage,
I see it's a little dusty, isn't it?
Is a piece of reddish-brown wood supported by a pedestal base.
This is the old Duncan Fife dining room table.
Less than 3 feet high, it stands tall in her mind.
There were 5 of us kids. Used to sit at it and do homework. And I guess I think the most important memory is that Dad bought it for Mom when they were married. And I think that's kind of special.
Kunkel has cherished her parents' table for four decades through four states.
It's been in every home that we've had. It's gone across the country, starting in Iowa and moved to Colorado, to California, and now Arizona.
Now that she's no longer using the table, Kunkel would like one of her three daughters to take it. Her oldest, 33-year-old Susan Kunkel, is her best chance, but no guarantee.
It's not exactly my style, but I do appreciate, you know, family heirlooms. I would like to keep it. I just don't have the space.
It's an interesting transition that I'm seeing going on.
Andrea Brundage is a professional organizer. She works with a lot of baby boomers who are downsizing.
Well, I think millennials are more disposable, and they've also seen us be burdened down with too much stuff, I think.
When kids turn down their parents' dresser or grandma's china, it can cause hurt feelings. Brundage has felt the pain herself. She was sure her daughters would fight over a dining room table, but neither wanted it. Brundage eventually sold it at a yard sale to a man who planned to give it to his daughter.
And of course, I just got very emotional because that's where that table was supposed to have gone.
A lot of older brown furniture makes its way to EJ's Auction and Consignment in Glendale, where owner Eric Hoyer says business is booming.
Probably tripled in the past 5 years, and the amount of estates that we're doing from the baby boomer generation because the kids don't want it. They don't, or they inherited it. They don't want it for their house.
Behind the showroom, where visitors can view items featured in weekly auctions,
let me pop you in the back here.
Is the processing area.
We have 5 moving trucks. We're picking up a minimum of one estate a day.
This is where items are unloaded, sorted, and cataloged. In one corner, a talking doll dressed in red, white, and blue is propped under bright lights waiting to be photographed while an employee conducts research.
So we're part of organizations that give us very large databases to be able to research and find out what the fair market value of something is.
Delivering the news to clients sometimes requires sensitivity, especially when dealing with antiques. That's anything more than 100 years old. Since the recession, Hoyer says, the antiques market has tanked.
They're not collecting that stuff anymore. The people that are collecting that antique furniture are the ones selling it.
Another example is porcelain figurines, commonly called hummels. The collectibles were popular in the 70s, but not today.
You know, those $300, $400 pieces are now, I mean, we'll group them together now in lots of 3 or 4 just to try to get $50 for them.
Hoyer estimates they turn away 60% of what they see. Rejection can be tough, as professional organizer Andrea Brundage knows. But she reminds herself and her clients that parents should never burden their children by forcing items on them they don't want.
And so when you put it that way to most people, they're reasonable.
Back at her garage in Phoenix, Claudia Kunkel gets it.
It's like, oh, I wish somebody would take it. But you can't feel bad because I had my own taste as well, you know, and they should be allowed to decide what they want in their home and what they don't want in their home.
If her children don't want her parents' oval table with the curved legs, Kunkel admits it might be time to let it go.
The value is really in the memories, isn't it?
Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia. But you can get in on the action, too. Just solve this riddle. I'm tall when I'm young, and I'm short when I'm old. What am I? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw 2 names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ Newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
The fall of 2009 saw the deaths of 3 people outside of Sedona in a sweat lodge ceremony. James Shore, Liz Newman, and Kirby Brown were overcome by the heat in the lodge, which was run by James Arthur Ray, a motivational speaker and author. Ray ended up behind bars for 2 years on negligent homicide charges. The events of that day and Ray's career are recounted in an upcoming CNN documentary called Enlighten Us, The Rise and Fall of James Arthur Ray. Mitch Horowitz is an author and historian who's included in the documentary, and he's with me. Mitch, how much have the self-help programs changed over the years? Are they similar to what they were decades ago, simply with more hyperbole and fireworks?
some people will bring a kind of dynamic personality into play. You know, Tony Robbins is an enormously charismatic guy. He also happens to proffer a lot of useful, helpful advice. I'm not one of these people who rolls my eyes at figures like Tony Robbins, but one has to understand what one is getting, and I think he would probably concede this himself. He is taking a kind of American metaphysical and motivational teaching that's been around for many decades, and he's supercharging it with his own personality. Sometimes he will add events like firewalks or things of that nature that are supposed to help convince people that they can stretch their physical and mental boundaries, overcome their fears. The fact is, if people are not paying ruinous sums of money, and if they're not being placed into any kind of physical jeopardy, there are lots of folks who feel that they get something out of these seminars.
At what stage do you start to get a little nervous with some of the research and the experience you've had?
When people are put through experiences that have not been appropriately and accurately advertised. And that does go on from time to time. What I mean is people think they're going to some kind of a motivational seminar, but they find they are presented with physically grueling challenges that they might not have been ready for. The most tragic such example of physically grueling challenges is James Ray's Sweat Lodge, which ended in horrible tragedy. People have to be made aware that if they are being put through or expected to participate in activities that could place them in physical jeopardy, and what kind of safety procedures are being taken, what kind of assurances are being offered that nobody's going to be pushed over the line. Peer pressure can also be a form of jeopardizing the individual. There are people who attend motivational or self-development or sometimes even yoga seminars for a weekend or a week-long retreat, and they are not made aware that there are going to be psychological and encounter group style methods being used, or in some rare cases, physically grueling methods being used.
Well, Mitch, I'm going to use the maybe a dangerous word in cult, and because there are some people who, after what happened with the James Arthur Ray Sweat Lodge situation, wondered about whether he had some sort of power over people or had put himself on a certain pedestal so that people had to think of him in a certain way. Is that overstating it? Or in the most dangerous of these situations, can the leader turn him or herself into someone who is sort of greater than the consequences?
Yes, and I think that's a good way of putting it. In the most dangerous circumstances, that can happen. But I would counsel people not to be too quick to use the term cult in a casual way. First of all, if a person is involved in a cult, by definition, at least colloquially speaking today, there's some kind of abusive relationships going on. People are being isolated. People are being taken advantage of. Now, in the case of James Ray, there are a small number of teachers, and I think James Ray was one of them, who used confrontational tactics in settings where people were, in fact, isolated. If you have traveled a long distance from your home, even if it's just for one weekend or even if it's for a week, and you are at a retreat center somewhere, you have nowhere else to go. That is your room and board. That is your lodging. That is where you're expecting to lay your head at night. And if you have a teacher who is behaving in an inappropriately confrontational fashion, I do think that is exerting pressure on participants that is unethical and that is wrong. And not only are people physically isolated in that situation, but they experience a great deal of peer pressure, because if you don't participate in some of the events, or if you don't go along with some of what the teacher is asking of you, you're seen as being, we'll say, something of a spoil sport. You're ruining it for other people. You're preventing other people from participating because you're not joining in. Or you may be told that your resistance to joining in is, in fact, your psychological resistance to solving some of your own problems. And you can understand how, in an isolated situation, that can put tremendous pressure on a person. I think each individual just has to be aware of that.
Mitch Horowitz is an author and historian. He appears in the new CNN documentary called Enlighten Us, The Rise and Fall of James Arthur Ray. It premieres on Thursday. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.